from Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very thankful for that support. Please keep it up. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, even in the current climate of hate facing many groups, this attack stood out. A historical black church in Mississippi was heavily damaged by fire Tuesday night. Suspicion of arson was reinforced by "Vote Trump" graffiti. One silver lining to this depressing cloud, a GoFundMe page with a $10,000 goal set up to raise funds for the damaged church had topped $150,000 in less than 24 hours. Despite repeated anti-Semitic chants at several Trump rallies this week, as well as an overt endorsement from the official KKK newspaper, campaign officials insist there is no reason their candidate might appeal to these kinds of fringe characters. They've also defended the free speech rights of these hateful voices, apparently not knowing that the First Amendment protects speech from suppression by the government and does not extend to the kind of expressions that so many find worrisome. For the Clinton campaign, there's just no telling what kind of expression is to be found in emails that have turned up on a computer used by Huma Abedin. Too soon to know what's there, according to the FBI, although not too soon to publicize the fact that there's something there, adding fuel to a fire that's already raging among many voters in this year's paranoia-laden campaign just days before Election Day. Oh, yeah, and Anthony Weiner has checked into rehab. An overwhelming vote by the City Council has made Washington, D.C. the sixth jurisdiction in the U.S. to provide a death with dignity bill, with provisions for assisted suicide allowed under narrowly defined conditions. And the Chicago Cubs won the World Series for the first time in over a century, proving to many that prayer really works. Just very, very, very slowly. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
In terms of what success would look like for COP22 in Marrakesh, I think that it was great to have an agreement last year. It was a historic, ambitious agreement, and now the rubber hits the road.
It's likely you haven't heard much about it, but a crucial global climate change gathering is happening this coming week. The 2016 United Nations Climate Conference will take place in Marrakesh, Morocco, focused on getting people of faith more engaged on this issue. The Reverend Donna Scopper is going to travel to that conference after the election, but not before speaking to us about it later on this week's show.
We will work for the common good and a renewed world, not for Christian privilege or cultural hegemony. We will demonstrate love for our nation, but always a critical patriotism. We will be grateful for democracy and make use of its access to power that we have with it, but aware of its deep vulnerability and its particular problems at any given moment.
An articulate voice addressing issues of concern to this population belongs to the theologian David Gushee, whose latest book is titled A Letter to My Anxious Christian Friends. Later in the hour, I'm looking forward to welcoming Dr. Gushee back to State of Belief Radio. But first,
Donald Trump, you're asking Americans to trust you with their future. Let me ask you, have you even read the United States Constitution? I will gladly lend you my copy.
It was a moment that's been hard to forget. in the middle of the kind of polished political speeches that typify a national convention, a quiet man, accompanied by his even quieter wife, rose to challenge the way a leading presidential candidate had been dismissing the service and sacrifice of Muslim Americans. Since then, Khizr Khan has defied the heartless conservative backlash to his message and has continued speaking out, refusing to allow his family's ultimate sacrifice to be dismissed. And as we all wrestle with what patriotism demands of us as Election Day draws near, I am honored to welcome Khizr Khan to State of Belief Radio. Mr. Khan, thank you for being with us.
Mr. Getty, I am so honored to be speaking with you, and through you, with your audience, I am so honored and so delighted and so humbled. Thank you.
You made a simple but very powerful point at the Democratic National Convention. I wish you would just summarize that point.
The purpose of going to the convention was to pay tribute to our son, but prior to accepting that invitation, we would visit our friends and their children would ask us the question about being thrown out of this country and not being interested in studies and worried and not eating well, not sleeping. So that had bothered us, and that is what was expressed in that speech at the bottom of our heart. And behind all of that humble speech and speaking and waving the Constitution was care for others, that my faith and other faiths have taught us that in this life, our Creator assigns all of us care of others. So we spoke with that in the back of our mind.
Mm-hmm. When did you become so knowledgeable of and devoted to the Constitution?
Well, I'll tell you, I was an undergrad student in Pakistan when I took a course called Comparative Study of the Constitution of the World. I read the Constitution in that course of Soviet Union, of Germany, Magna Carta for British system, and Constitution of United States. At that early age, I could not pass without my eyes welling and my hands trembling when I read the Declaration of Independence, the difficulties that this nation had gone through to come together to gain its independence, very similar to a few hundred years afterwards. We had the same difficulty in gaining our independence, and that caught my attention and my interest. So I had been a student of the history of the United States and its Constitution ever since. I am not a constitutional lawyer or a scholar. I am a mere student of Constitution, but it means so very much. I have read it again and again, and I am so honored to be living and receiving the goodness of this country, goodness of this nation, under the foundation of the values enshrined in Constitution.
Do you find anything in the United States Constitution that contradicts or compromises your Muslim faith?
Not at all. It grants me equal dignity and equal rights regardless of my faith. It gives me far much better rights than I have in the Muslim world. It grants me the right to practice my religion, practice my freedoms without any hesitation, without any burden, without any restriction. I have not neither noticed nor felt, and I continue to live. It's been 35 years. Not a single day has gone by that ever we have encountered any restriction or any contradiction. Not at all.
What do you think many of the American people don't understand about Islam that they need to understand in order to provide all people the same rights, privileges, and freedoms that you understand should already be guaranteed?
We are testament to the goodness of America. Most America understands their values, understands this equal dignity to all and consideration of all faiths equal. It is only a small number, a minority, that has gotten the definition of Muslims and Islam through some unfortunate events that have taken place, regrettably some violence, regrettably some activities by a small number of Muslims. I cannot exclude them. My religion doesn't allow me to exclude them from faith, but they have practiced violence and the act of violence on innocent people that is against the spirit of my religion. So I implore my brothers and sisters in the United States to look beyond that. They have hijacked, because of their limited understanding of their own faith, all this violence, all this terrorist activities outside the United States and here is not part of my faith. My faith says, and this is part of the last sermon of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and he said, hurt no one and you will not be hurt. Hmm. He insisted on equal dignity of all faiths, and that Muslims are bound to must treat all other faiths with equal dignity. Somehow, this small number of people in other parts of the world have totally misunderstood or intentionally ignored the peaceful teaching of my faith. So I request those friends that have gotten to know Islam and Muslims through these unfortunate events or media reporting of those events to go beyond that. There are 1.6 billion Muslims in the world. They all condemn this violence that is taking place. It's only 80 to 90,000 people that live in the tribal mentality that they have kept their emphasis on fighting, on exclusion, on not treating with equal dignity of other faiths and other religions. That is totally against the spirit of Islam.
I know all too well, personally, the relentlessness with which the political right in this country goes after those that it sees as its enemies. How have you handled the backlash that you've experienced, your wife faced? How do you continue speaking out as you do and knowing those critics are there?
Sir, we are fully cognizant of that. But I tell you this, and I gain strength from people like yourself, sir, and your audience. There are more good people in this country than those that have limited vision of the leadership of this country. So whenever we meet, whenever we are on streets, aeroplane, airports, personally folks are reaching out to us, sending us letters of encouragement. There are only handful of letters of discouragement, and we can identify that letter as soon as it arrives. The sender will not put his or her name on return address and will not put their name at the bottom of the letter. And that speaks to the moral courage of that gesture of dislike, gesture of hatred. On the other hand, the people that are encouraging us to continue with our message of emphasizing the goodness of this country, the values of this country, is such an enormous number. Our tables are full. We are receiving presents and gifts of scripture, prayers highlighted in Bible, the texts, Old Testament, New Testament, Holy Quran. They're just amazing, amazing outpouring of love. So we are heartened that we should continue our journey in the goodness of this country, but we extend the hand of understanding their point of view as well. They are our brothers and sisters, and the reconciliation cannot begin without extending an open heart and open courtesy and open acceptance of their point of view, but holding hand, as common mission is to live, survive happily under the foundation, under the goodness of this country. So we are heartened, in fact, and we will continue our message, which is that now that the elections are going to be over, the whole country needs to come together, remove the division, and realize the problems. There are some genuine issues. There are some genuine problems, and the dialogue should begin. I was reading the difficulties, the history, and the dialogue that took place when our Constitution was being framed, when our Bill of Rights was being framed, what a difficulty our forefathers had, disagreements they have had, but at the bottom of their hearts and at the bottom of their struggle was goodness for the country, goodness for the nation, and how to set the wonderful foundation that we continue to enjoy even today. So I remind everybody that this Constitution, the values that we cherish so much, didn't come together without little difficulty. There had been disagreements, arguments, to a level much greater than what we face today. But at the end of the argument was that we wish our country well, we wish our nation well. Let's come together and continue the dialogue, and through dialogue we deal with our differences. I share a simple event that took place just a few days ago. I was sitting in an aeroplane on seat number 8. Two gentlemen, two wonderfully distinguished gentlemen, got up from seat number 1 and 2 and came to me in the plane and said, "Mr. Khan," I said, "Yes." I said, "Mr. Khan, we are Republicans. We want you to please get up from this seat and come and sit at our seat, and let us treat you. We want you to know that we have exactly same respect for you and for your gesture of reminding us our enshrined values in the Constitution and the goodness of our country. We respect you equally same. Please come and sit at our seat." It heartens me to see, and this is not one example, I just a story of the goodness of the people regardless of party affiliation. So we cling on to those sentiments and that goodness of American people, and that is where lies moving forward, accepting the new arrival, accepting the refugees, and opening your heart with understanding of other faiths and Muslims. Muslims are as patriotic as in Arlington Cemetery. Whenever I go to pay a visit to my son, Captain Humayun Khan, there are 5 other Muslims right next to one another in the cemetery, section 60. They're all Muslims. They're Gold Star families that come there, and we meet them. And there are others as well that come there. We are all for the defense of this country, for the defense of the values of this country, and defense of this nation. And there are about 5,000 active duty serving Muslims in the armed forces that defend this country on a daily basis. And the nation is realizing, slowly and gradually, this nation is, and this country is realizing the contribution that we all equally continue to make, regardless of our faith.
I can't end the interview without asking you to say just a word to the American people on the eve of this election. What are your thoughts today about that?
Sir, I am first so honored. Nowhere else in the world this would be happening, that this person that is still learning English, is still learning how to speak correctly and all this, is given this opportunity to address through your esteemed network and with your audience, have this conversation. No one... This incident of my speaking with you, sir, speaks volume about this country's values, about this country's goodness. We need to focus on that. We need to move forward. We need to remember the values when we go to vote. We remember that how we can continue to strengthen these values. These values make us envy of the world. These values make us show the better way to live to this mankind. Believe me, I have experienced it. I have seen the world. The rest of the humanity looks towards the United States because of its values, because of its goodness, to lead the world, to lead the humanity to a better direction. And we should be cognizant of electing our leader with those values, which will move us forward, enhance our leadership in the world, and show the rest of the world a better way. And I am very hopeful that America will make the right decision, because America realizes its values. America is very appreciative of the candidates that enhance those values, that include everyone and move us forward for the sake of better humanity, for the sake of better leadership of the United States. And I'm so grateful that I am speaking with you. I'll end this conversation 15th of December of 2016 is 225th anniversary of Bill of Rights. Washington, D.C. is celebrating that 225th anniversary. Original Bill of Rights are going to be on display. And this speaks to the goodness of this country. This speaks to the wonderful value of this country. Guess who has been invited to speak to that event? This humble citizen of this country. I am a testament to the goodness of this country. Nobody can convince me that there is malice in the hearts of Americans. Our Creator has created this country for a purpose, and that purpose is being fulfilled by showing the leadership, showing the goodness of this country.
Mr. Khan, you are the embodiment of a person of faith who is also a real patriot. I can't express enough my appreciation for you taking the time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much, sir. God bless you, and may your message resonate not within the United States, but throughout the world. Thank you very much.
David P. Gushee is the Distinguished University Professor of Christian Ethics and Director of the Center for Faith and Public Life at Mercer University in Macon, Georgia. A prolific writer, he's the author of numerous influential books, most recently, A Letter to My Anxious Christian Friends, From Fear to Faith in Unsettled Times. David, welcome back to State of Belief.
Thank you, Welton. Good to be back.
What's making our Christian friends so darned anxious?
It depends on what Christian friends we're talking about. The book was written in the fall of 2015, and I was sensing, especially white Christian anxiety, was contributing to the rise of Donald Trump, and in general contributing to the tone of the political campaign. Anxiety over demographic change, anxiety over religious change, decline of Christianity, anxiety over immigration, over crime, over terrorism, over change in general. And I think that's still true. And now, of course, with the candidates that we ended up with, all kinds of anxieties over all kinds of things. How about whether we have a contested election on Tuesday, I mean, mm-hmm. as in like no result at the end of the day, whether we have competent candidates who could actually run the country, whether each side will accept the legitimacy of whoever the winner is. I mean, the anxieties have only deepened since I wrote the book.
I think in my own thoughts, my anxieties go in the direction that you've just talked about of what's happened in this election campaign. I honestly can say I don't have a lot of anxiety about Christianity. And I'd like to hear you talk about that, because historically, Christianity itself has often thrived in unsettled times, even in times of real negative pressures. Talk about that and relate it to your book.
I think that the big, big picture, 30,000-foot view, is that many conservative white Christians are in a state of grief and nostalgia over the loss of Christian cultural power mm-hmm. and the unquestioned dominance of Christian symbols, beliefs, loyalty or stated loyalty in public life. Mm-hmm. So part of what I do in the book is to say that, yes, as you said, Welton, the Christian faith and Christian discipleship does not depend on cultural power mm-hmm. and, in fact, sometimes does better without it, because you have less merely cultural Christianity when there is less to be gained by a merely cultural Christian affiliation. Mm-hmm. People who want to claim Christian identity and to say that they're followers of Jesus do so just because they believe it, because they want to, as opposed to it'll help you get your next business deal or get elected. So in that sense, it's purifying.
Mm-hmm. What do you think are the biggest misconceptions among different groups in the nation that drive fear and anxiety and perpetuate the division?
I think we have almost reached the point where we believe that the people on the other side don't love America and don't want it to do well. Mm. especially the way some people have talked about President Obama. Mm-hmm. I don't even know whether he's for us. He's, who knows what his agenda is. I mean, that kind of thing. Anytime you take that level of suspicion of a public leader in any party, I think you're really in trouble. So just assuming goodwill and a desire to advance the well-being of the country, we ought to be able to do that. But, I mean, I think that we have vastly exaggerated fears of Muslims. I think we have vastly exaggerated fears of immigrants. Right now, I think in most parts of the country, at least, we have vastly exaggerated fears of crime and of terrorism, of the decline of the U.S. In the world and the decline of our economy. But one thing that makes it all difficult is we are such a vast country, continent-wide, with multiple, I say this in the book, multiple regional cultures and multiple pockets that have different experiences than other groups do. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if you're in coal country and jobs are going away, that's a different experience than people who are in other parts of the country where the economy is booming. I think we need more inter-regional conversations in which we listen to the diversity of our experiences. And we also may need more state-level and regional-level solutions instead of everything being addressed at the national level.
I'm concerned about what happens after the election, and I'm particularly interested in what's going to happen in the evangelical community. There has been obviously a tremendous drive to participate in this election in a way that many of them feel will be most beneficial for Christianity. But in the public's eye, they have kind of turned their backs on Christian values in order to win an election. I'm interested in what you think about the evangelical community's response to Mr. Trump winning the election or Mr. Trump losing the election.
One of the stories of the election is that the Republican coalition has been shaken to the core and that there is division, all kinds of divisions. The class and educational divisions have surfaced in a way they never have before. And kind of leadership elites have found themselves with less power and a kind of a populist revolt with more power. Interesting, a populist revolt led by a billionaire, but there you go. I guess stranger things have happened. Mm. But the leadership elites of the evangelical community have in general not been terribly warm towards Donald Trump, but a lot in the grassroots have. And especially since the Access Hollywood video came out, divisions among male and female evangelical leaders and sometimes among younger and older evangelicals have come up. And certainly among evangelicals who have comfortable jobs and those who are really more working class folks who have resonated more with Donald Trump's message. I still think that white evangelicals, not black and Hispanic and Asian, are likely to still vote for the Republican candidate at about the normal rate, 70 to 80%. We'll see. If it falls much below that, it'll really hurt them. I think that some of the most visible evangelical and fundamentalist leaders who have endorsed Mr. Trump, despite everything, have lost a lot of credibility, gone on TV, defended, and found awkward ways to try to explain away things that shouldn't be explained away. I think they will have lost a lot of credibility. I think that if he wins, they get plunged into the roller coaster ride that would be a Trump presidency. And I wonder how long, whether they will, you know, will just kind of be on that roller coaster with him, come what may. I've also been struck by the gullibility. I might write about this soon, but the gullibility of some of these folks. If Mr. Trump says he's a born-again Christian, then we believe him, and he's just a baby Christian, just working on stuff. You know, if he makes certain kinds of promises to evangelicals, then just because he said it, we believe it. I don't know where that kind of gullibility came from. It's certainly not taught in the Bible. And if he loses, who knows? You know, do they join the chorus of efforts to delegitimize the Clinton presidency from the very beginning, to prosecute, to impeach? I don't know. There are some shining lights. There are people who have done better, like Russell Moore, but there have also been people who have tied themselves to the Donald Trump mast, which I, in light of everything, I find pretty much incomprehensible.
Tell me where you personally see hope coming from.
I see hope coming from the solidity of American institutions and the American people, a political and moral culture developed over 240 years. I also see hope among a more multicultural America. I like what I'm hearing from a lot of the non-white evangelicals who have some perspective that is going to help to change the evangelical conversation. So I would say our historic culture and the newly emerging voices who have been on the margins. But it's going to be a rocky transition to get from where we are to a new era. But I believe we will make it. And I think Christians are called to play a constructive role in that.
David P. Gushee is the Distinguished University Professor of Christian Ethics and Director of the Center for Faith and Public Life at Mercer University. He's the author of numerous influential books. We've talked today about A Letter to My Anxious Christian Friends, From Fear to Faith in Unsettled Times. And I have to say, David, that what you've told us has stirred the anxieties, but you also, even in those closing words, have given us a reason for hope and something to hold on to. Thank you for being with us once again on State of Belief Radio.
It's always my pleasure. Thank you.
The Reverend Dr. Donna Scopper is senior minister at Judson Memorial Church in New York City. Next week brings the 2016 United Nations Climate Conference to Marrakesh, Morocco. And with not a little frustration at how this issue has been sidelined in an election year in this country, Reverend Scopper is on November 15th heading to that conference. And so, Donna, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Why, on the weekend before the national elections, would you give time to talking about climate change?
We suffer from short-term itis in this country, and we rarely get to the longer views. I'm focusing on climate change because the candidates aren't, and because this is a democracy and somebody's got to do it.
Donna, you wrote about the issue of climate change in terms of deferred maintenance. I know that's a metaphor that you've used before. I want you to talk a little about what that means, if you would.
Well, we have deferred maintenance of both the infrastructure, the ridiculous dependence we have on fossil fuels, the time to get rid of them and to transition to more renewable energies was a decade ago. And now we're facing what can only be described as a near catastrophe. So what I'm trying to do is to use what I think of as the strongest renewable energy, which is the power of a democratic spirit and people who come together. It's even stronger than the wonderful powers of solar and wind. And we are seeing increases in the way solar and wind are being invested in, are being used, and the way people are dropping out of fossil fuels. And I'm trying to argue that we religious people and spiritual people also talk about our renewable energy and renewing our own hope and our own passion for great democracy.
You write about different approaches and different theologies. Expand on that, if you will.
The theology I'd like to be coming from is a sacramental enchantment one, that we re-sacralize what has been desacralized. That being said, I think there's an enormous amount of darkness and sin floating around in our short-term itis and the way we disregard the great gifts of creation. So I'm afraid that if we don't do some things fairly soon to really make a very much more serious transition to renewables, that we're going to be forced into authoritarian methods. Things will happen that will take away people's power to choose, and we'll end up having to tax gasoline $1 a gallon from the top down. Mm-hmm. Or we'll end up having to say you can't drive a car without four people in it. Because otherwise, we won't be able to make the change, that something twice as big as Sandy will happen, and people will wake up and say, oh, my God, it's almost too late. So I'm trying to stay away from that, what I call punishmentalist dark theology, where we really have to confront the evil that we've done to what God gave us. So I'm trying to stick with the sacramental and enchanting and resacralized theology, but as a good progressive, I see darkness ahead.
You know, with the exception of what's going on there, the climate crisis really has been swept from the headlines in the United States. That's not the case in other parts of the world. Isn't that accurate to say?
You know, I covered COP21 last year, and I was overwhelmed and astonished by the beautiful things that are going on in other countries. I think Europe is very much ahead of us, has been for some time. Now, I mean, I met with African women and Indian, you know, country of India people who were doing enormously important things. And China, believe it or not, is certainly going through the industrial phase where it's not so good, and believe me, it's not good for us. But there's a lot of action in China. And back to my concern about authoritarian moves, it will not surprise me to see China make very large changes very quickly.
Donna, what are your personal goals for making the trip to Marrakesh, and what are your expectations, and what kind of deliveries do you expect experiencing there?
Well, you know, let me just say, I think of myself, you know, obviously primarily as a pastor and a preacher, and I find that I am mightily fed by what other people think, and by experiences like Morocco or last year in Paris, or frankly, the United Church of Christ sent me to the International Meeting of Women in 1995 in Beijing, and it changed my life. They sent me to the World Parliament of Religions, and it changed my life in 1999. I went to the slow food movement, the first one in Italy with Carlo Petrini, and it changed my life. So my goals are to be as well-educated as I am about hopeful people and hopeful initiatives, and to spread them around so that we get people out of this kind of trench of cynicism into seeing real possibilities, again, spiritually and democratically. We've lost faith in ourselves.
And that transitions into my next question, which kind of comes full circle from where we started. But expand, please, on the spiritual components of environmental stewardship, because from that, as I see it, not only comes a better understanding of our responsibility, but also encouragement and strength for doing what has to be done.
I think the spiritual role is encouragement. It's giving people the capacity to hope, especially under the circumstances of utter despair that most people are living in right now. I mean, when you really listen to the conversation about this election, basically people are in major lament. Say, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. It's not good for people to be in that state. We need to be saying things like, I will not move to Canada. You know, how many times have you heard that?
I've heard it a lot.
You're not going to move to Canada.
Right.
I mean, plus you'll be really lonely there.
Yes.
You know, so what are you going to do? And I think what we want to hear people say is, I'm going to double down. I'm going to find my little project, and I'm going to work the heaven out of it. And I'm going to believe that what I do matters, as opposed to thinking that what I do does not matter. Because the people in charge love nothing better than you're thinking you don't matter.
You know, Donna, I have the strong feeling that if more people could hear you and understand what you're saying, we would make more progress in dealing with this issue. What is your long-term vision or strategy for increasing attention to this crucial issue?
Well, you know, writing, thinking, talking is my little niche. Certainly creating congregations like Judson, who are very strong and very hopeful, and where people are capable of acting. I speak of my life mission often as spiritual nurture for public capacity. And I can't say enough about the capable people at Judson Memorial Church doing everything they can.
The Reverend Dr. Donna Scopper is senior minister at Judson Memorial Church in New York City. Right after the election, November 15th, she's heading to Marrakesh for the 2016 United Nations Climate Conference. We'll link to her compelling article about approaching the climate change crisis in new theological ways, and we'll follow her dispatches from Morocco at stateofbelief.com. Donna, safe travels, and thank you so much for being with us again to talk about this critical issue in the lives of all of the people of the world. We always value your presence on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Before we go, few, if any of us, have not been frustrated, disgusted, and discouraged at some point during this long, harrowing presidential campaign. Emotions have spanned the spectrum from hope to despair, anger to discouragement, conviction to confusion, and a passion for politics to a disdain for politicians. Repetitive pivots, mounting numbers of Pinocchios, and endless campaign speeches that sound more like the rhetoric of street fights than presidential campaigns have been enough to make even the most patient among us throw up our hands and say, "I give up." What can we do? It's out of our hands. We don't like any of the options on the ballot to elect a new president. Why encourage any of the candidates by voting? Such are the sentiments of scores of would-be voters that feel like the presidential campaign has involved varied forms of political abuse and bullying rather than an elaboration of policy alternatives and a reaffirmation of our democracy. Well, finally, Election Day is now only hours away. It's a time for the candidates to listen to us. What we say by our vote will determine their futures as well as ours. What can we do? Vote. Vote. Every citizen in this nation has an obligation to cast a ballot to elect a new president on Election Day. I am aware that the sanctity of voting seems a bit tarnished this time around. Even high-ranking political leaders in our nation tell us they will vote for a candidate that they know cannot win, for individuals who are not even on the ballot, because they say they don't like the nominated candidates in their respective parties, but they do want to be able to say they voted. Look, such people are playing a dangerous game more than responsibly taking care of our nation. A wasted vote is no better than not voting. With civic responsibility comes moral responsibility. To do the best we can do to support our democratic process by selecting the best possible candidate for the presidency to sit in the Oval Office with determination to uphold our Constitution, assure the rights of all people, and protect the public's welfare at home and abroad. That is our political duty, and that is our moral mandate. I was moved to hear the words of Governor Bill Weld on the Rachel Maddow Show in this past week. The Libertarian Party's nominee for vice president, who fully understands that a 5% showing nationwide on November the 8th would catapult his party to a whole new level of competitiveness 4 years from now. And yet, because his own conscience identifies one of the major party nominees as dangerous and unacceptable, he put patriotism above party in making clear that in battleground states, defeating a candidate he sees as dangerous must take precedence even over his own political future. How refreshing in an election season more typically marred by politicians who spent months articulating the unprecedented dangers and flaws of a given candidate only ultimately to fall in line to support that same candidate. Don't make this election cycle worse than it already has been. If you have not already voted in this election, please do so on Tuesday. Yes, it has been a dirty, disturbing campaign in which truth was sacrificed for popularity and fear-mongering has taken the place of meaningful discussions on policies. But we only will perpetuate the ugly side of politics if we don't vote responsibly. Does one person's vote matter? You better believe it. We do have power. Indeed, our votes will elect the next leader of the free world. Now, what could be more important than casting a vote for the candidate on the ballot that you have decided will best strengthen our nation by preserving our Constitution and assuring equal rights and freedoms for all citizens in this nation? Your opinion counts only if you cast a vote for a candidate on the ballot that will be counted. How could any of us who pledge allegiance to this nation do less? Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it with them. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. The community that's grown around State of Belief Radio is active all week long online. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, vote if you have not voted. You all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. See what he was.